Well, you know, there comes a time when you need to ask yourself, what's going on in this universe? I'm trying to figure this out myself. Up next, Greg Braden joins us as we talk deep truth, igniting the memory of our origin, history, destiny, and fate on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. You know, we've had a lot of great thinkers, a lot of great minds on this program over the years. We've got one for you tonight. Greg Braden, of course, back on Coast to Coast, former senior computer systems designer for Martin Marietta, computer geologist for Phillips Petroleum. Greg is considered a pioneer in bridging the wisdom of our past with the science, healing, and peace of our future. For more than 20 years, he has searched the remote monasteries of Egypt, Peru, Tibet for life-giving secrets that were encoded in the language of cherished traditions. He's just a great author. He's been on our program for years. We're going to talk tonight about his latest work called Deep Truth. And Greg, I got to tell you, I can't think of a better time when a story like Deep Truth is needed. Man, what is happening out there?
Hey, George, it's good to hear your voice tonight. I am thrilled to be on this program and really very excited about all this material that we're going to be able to share tonight. This is one of those nights where each topic could be an entire program unto itself, and we're going to cover so much new material and bring this all together in a really empowering way. So I appreciate so much the opportunity to be back on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, my pleasure. What's happening out there, Greg? I sense it. People sense it. They call the program. I meet with people at events. There's something going on. I can't put my finger on it, but I feel it. How about you?
Well, George, I got to tell you, in the last 5 years, I've been on every continent of the earth, with the exception of Antarctica. We haven't done any programs in Antarctica yet. But we've been all over the world, not every country, but every continent. And it's not just the New Thought community. It's not just North America or Western civilization. People all over the world know that something is up. And even those who have been reluctant to embrace the fact that the world we've come to trust and rely upon is gone, and we are emerging into a new world that's happening before our very eyes every day. Even those that are reluctant to embrace that fact have now awakened to the fact that something is up, and I'll tell you where it hit them the hardest was in their economic pocketbook.
Yes.
And this is what has grabbed so many people's attention, George, is the economic collapse the collapse of the global economies. That is happening as we speak. And for many people, it looks to them like it just happened. Of course, I know for our Coast to Coast listeners, we've been ahead of the curve, for 20 years now, knowing that something was going on. So I think maybe the place to begin tonight is to talk about a context, what it is that's driving the changes, why we have approached many of the changes the way we have, the false assumptions of science that have led us to the brink of losing all that we cherish as a civilization, what the new discoveries show, and then where we can go from there. So if you're all right with that, I think that'd be a good way to go tonight.
It sure will. And let's hope that by the end of tonight, Greg, we give some people some hope and some understanding about things they can do in order to get through this mess, because it's going to be like going through a huge spider web, isn't it?
Well, it is, George, and you know, as I said earlier, it is not our imagination. And what I now have come to understand, many mainstream scientists now are asking the question, what's going on? And the reason they're asking is because they're steeped in the traditions of an outdated and obsolete science. New discoveries are giving us new information that help us to solve the problems and make sense of the changes and the crises in our world. But those new discoveries, George, are not being embraced in the mainstream. Mainstream media, mainstream documentaries, mainstream classrooms, mainstream textbooks are not carrying many of the peer-reviewed scientific discoveries that change 300 years of scientific thinking about our relationship to ourselves and our world and our past, our history and our origins. They're not carrying that, and for that reason, many of the crises that we see today simply don't make sense. So it is not our imagination. The best minds of our time are telling us, in no uncertain terms, that this generation, in these years, we are living the greatest number of crises, and each crisis is of the greatest magnitude ever to face humankind in recorded history as we know it today. And they're telling us, George, that we've got to act. We've got to do something. We've got about 5 to 8 years to figure this out, or not much else is going to make any difference. This is where this material comes in from deep truth.
Well, it's very timely, Greg. It's perfect.
Yeah, well, the question I asked myself as I began writing this book a few years ago, the best minds of our time are telling us we've got to act, and the question is, how can we possibly make the choices, George, that affect our future and our very survival until we understand the deepest essence of our existence? And how can we get to that essence if the facts are not being shared in mainstream, if the masses are not allowed to benefit from the science, the very good science, peer-reviewed discoveries that are not being carried in the mainstream? So it was in 2005, just in case there's any doubt in anyone's mind, 2005, the journal Scientific American came out with a special edition, and the title tells the whole story. The title was called Crossroads for Planet Earth. And this was an important edition because it was the scientists and the engineers, the social architects, the philosophers, the spiritual and the religious leaders all coming together from many different perspectives, telling the world, hey, something is up, and identifying the crises, everything from the shortage of fresh water and food and the growing threat of global war. They knew that there was an economic collapse that was on the horizon. All of these things are identified by the scientific community in the year 2005. And it was them giving the rest of the world the heads up on what was happening. And at the very beginning of this special edition, Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson made an amazing statement, and I'd just like to share it.
Sure.
What he said is that we are entering what he called the bottleneck in time. And I love the imagery that creates. He said we're entering this bottleneck in time when our resources, so our emotional resources, our psychological resources, our physical resources, and our ability to solve our problems be pushed to the limits. And so, George, I think that is what we're sensing now, that is that we are in this bottleneck of time. Mainstream science is only beginning to acknowledge it publicly. Our indigenous ancestors have told us for 5,000 years this time was coming.
They always knew.
They always knew because it always does. And I think this is a good place to provide some context for what's happening here. The changes that we're experiencing here on Earth, we are living a beautiful, perfect storm of rare cyclic changes on the Earth that are pushing the way we think and the way we live to the limits. Our unsustainable ways of living are what are being tested, and those are the things that are collapsing right now. And our ancestors knew that this time was coming, and our own science now is beginning to acknowledge it because it's based upon Earth's position in space. The tilt, the angle, the wobble, the orbit, on a rhythmic basis, on a cyclic basis, we know these things change over long periods of time. The problem is the changes haven't happened within the memory of this generation or this civilization, but they change on this rhythmic basis. And I can tell you, George, as a former geologist, very accustomed to looking into the sediments and the ice cores of our past, and we can talk about this more as we go through the program tonight.
And also, Greg, you pointed something out about how these things, whatever they are just monumental these days. And you look at the weather changes, you look at the political climate, you look at the economic climate, you look at our health, you look at all these things, and they're every area, it's major. There's not some little thing that happens anymore. They're all of just incredible magnitude, aren't they?
Well, they are, and this is now what, you know, we have sensed this, and as I said, I know to a large extent our coast-to-coast audience is the choir, and we're sharing this information with a choir tonight. But the key to us transcending these crises, George, is for us to think differently than we have ever thought before. And we have good reasons to change our thinking. The science is there. But if we're going to do that, we've got to reach way beyond the choir. We've got to find the language to reach into the CEOs of corporations and the leaders of nations who are making the choices. And in the Western world, in the modern world, that language is the language of science. It's the language that we trust, that we've come to rely upon. And for that reason, I've chosen the language of science to share the new discoveries in the book Deep Truth. So what I'd like to do at the very beginning, just right off the bat, I'd like to share a quote from Nobel Prize-winning physicist Niels Bohr that he made. It was a quote that came from a conversation he was having with Albert Einstein in the mid-20th century.
And he was my science teacher's favorite physicist of his day.
Well, yeah. he was a brilliant man, and it was his words that led to the title of this book and the theme of where this book comes from. Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein were having a conversation about the nature of truth. And in this case, they were talking about scientific truths. And George, it's one of those statements. I always wonder if even Niels Bohr knew how profound his statement was at the time that he made it. But I'm going to share it with our audience here tonight, just to begin our program. And what he said is this. He said, quote, "It is the hallmark of any deep truth that its negation is also a deep truth." And the first time I heard that, I mean, first thing I thought was, wow, it's really deep. And as I began to think about what that statement means in our lives, in our world today, much of the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to one another and our relationship to the earth and the way we solve our problems is based in the science of the last 300 years and what were considered deep truths of that science. New discoveries are now overturning many of those scientific principles, so the new discoveries should become the new deep truths. But it's the reluctance of mainstream science to share these discoveries, peer-reviewed discoveries made by using accepted scientific methods, but they're simply not being carried in mainstream media and classrooms and textbooks. And this is where the problem comes in. We're trying to solve the great crises of our time with the same thinking that led to the crises and our response to those crises.
Do people care, though, Greg? Do the people who run things, do they really understand this?
You know, George, it's a good question. And up until recently, or do they care? Maybe is
or do they care? That's even bigger.
Even a better question. I think up until recently, the answer to that may have been no, that they really didn't care because they didn't feel the effects of the changes. But as you mentioned, excuse me, so clearly, the effects are so widespread now that it's impossible not to feel the effects. Many people I know, I'm less than a week back from a tour in Western Europe, and many of the people that I spoke with are waiting for things to settle down. They're waiting for the world to get back to normal. And when I ask them what that means, they say, we're waiting for the world to get back to the way it was, you know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. And I think this is one of the keys that we're all faced with now, George. The world that we have grown to trust and become accustomed to.
And love is gone.
And love and that way of life, it's gone. It disappeared before our eyes while we were watching. And when we read the traditions of those who have come before us, and we read the science in the late 1800s and early 1900s, what we come to understand, it's fascinating to me, is that the world that's disappeared was never meant as the destination. It was never meant as the world that was supposed to last forever. It was designed as a stepping stone. The technology of the 20th century, for example, and the ways of thinking, many of the principles of the 20th century, they were designed as a stepping stone to get us to the next level. And as that world is disappearing, and it looks like everything's just falling apart at the seams, if we look closely, what we find is the only things that are breaking down are the ways of thinking and the ways of life that are no longer sustainable in the presence of the changes that Earth is undergoing right now. The stress of global change is pushing our ways of thinking and living to the limits. And
did we did
work well, and the ones that don't are the ones that are falling apart, like the economic system that we're witnessing right now.
Did we let them do this to us, or did we do it to ourselves?
I've asked myself the same question, George, and where I have come with that is if I don't know that we did it to ourselves consciously, and I'm not going to say that, but I think we're all living a massive learning curve. And this is where the information tonight is going to become very important, because one of the deep truths of our past is that civilization is, in fact, cyclic. The advanced civilization is cyclic. And in our schools and in our textbooks, we're taught civilization is 5,000 years old, and it began during the time of ancient Sumeria and Mesopotamia. And what we find is the facts do not support that. That is the civilization of the most recent cycle. But there were cycles before that and cycles before that. So when we talk about doing it to ourselves, it's about what it is that we have remembered, what we've forgotten, and the way we think of our relationship to the world. Because the way that we respond to the crises that face us at any time in history, it's based in the way we think of ourselves. Who are we? When we ask ourselves, who are we as individuals, as communities and nations, the answer to that question is what determines when we go to war, when we create peace, when and how we share resources, when we take a human life and when we spare a human life. It's all based on the way we think of ourselves. And much of that in the modern world comes directly from scientific assumptions that we now know are false. So as we go through this, the new discoveries tonight, we'll begin to understand the false assumptions that have led to the crises and why it makes no sense to try to solve the crises through the same kind of thinking that led to them in the first place.
But who breaks down those barriers, those false assumptions that we picked up from things that we thought were correct? Who breaks them down?
Well, you know, the media has a lot to do with this, George. I mean, the science is out there. I was trained as a scientist. I believe in the scientific method. I think science is good. Science has definitely served us. And to keep science honest, we must honor what is called the scientific method. The scientific method essentially says when we find the new discoveries that no longer support the existing beliefs, those new discoveries must be incorporated into the existing beliefs. And this is what's not happening today. There are stories about human origins, stories about civilization, stories about our Darwinian theories of survival of the strongest, survival mm-hmm. of the fittest. These stories are so entrenched into our thinking, into our corporations, into the way we do business, into the economic system of the world. They're so entrenched that there's a reluctance to change those stories, even when the discoveries show us that the thinking is no longer correct. So it's us. It's up to us to change this thinking and to bring it to the attention in a responsible way. What I have found to be true, George, is when the facts are clear, then the choices become obvious.
Greg, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more. You call the work Deep Truth. Let's find out why when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you know, that's Paul Anka. I ran into him at an event about a year ago in Los Angeles. And, you know, just what a superb guy. A lot of people don't know it, but he wrote a lot of the home run songs that Frank Sinatra sang as well. He's a great songwriter and a great singer himself. He's from Canada, by the way. We're going to come back in a moment. Deep Truth with Greg Braden on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Greg Braden with us. Greg, you call your latest work Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. Tell me about that, the title. How'd you get that?
Well, the title, as we mentioned in the first part of the program, is based on a statement that that Niels Bohr made to Albert Einstein in the conversation about the nature of truth, and it is the negation of any deep truth, the hallmark of any deep truth, that its negation is also a deep truth. And I think this is precisely where we find ourselves today. We're looking at multiple crises of the greatest magnitude that we've ever faced, and we're asking ourselves why so many things are happening all at the same time why such big problems are all converging in this little window of time.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at the way we think of our relationship to the world, the science that we've relied upon to tell us who we are in the world, what we're seeing is these new discoveries are overturning what were considered deep truths of the past. So this is what Niels Bohr was talking about. When we negate one deep truth, the discovery that negates it becomes the new deep truth. So this book is about the deep truths of science, peer-reviewed science. We find in the very technical journals that's not being shared in the mainstream, but it's the very science that changes the way that we have been led to think of ourselves and our relationship to the world. And it's these discoveries, I think, that open the door to the possibility of us moving beyond the great crises that face us today.
And the way we were led to believe, did they want us to believe it on purpose, or maybe they didn't know either?
You know, I think different answers apply to deep truths, George. In the book, we talk about five deep truths. Let me just list them.
All right.
And then I can answer your question with a couple of these, and we'll tie them into some of the Darwinian beliefs. And I think that's a good place to begin tonight. Five key assumptions of science. When I was in school, when you were in school, most of our listeners, when they were in school, our listeners' children in school today are being taught these five assumptions. So I'd like to share them, and then we can go through these and see what the new discoveries are telling us.
Okay.
One of the discoveries, the first one, is that evolution explains life itself, number one, and number two, it explains human life. Okay, the key assumption number two is that civilization began only about 5,000 years ago. Assumption number three is that consciousness is separate from our physical world. Assumption number four is that the space between things is empty. And assumption number five is that nature is based upon survival of the fittest, interpreted as survival of the strongest. Now, these are five very different assumptions. They cover a lot of ground. But when we ask ourselves the question, George, who are we in the world? Who am I? We ask ourselves as individuals. What we'll find is much of the way we answer is based upon, either consciously or subconsciously, is based upon the way that we've been led to think of ourselves through these assumptions. Now, every one of the assumptions I just shared is absolutely false. It is scientifically proven to be false. But it is still being taught in mainstream media and mainstream classrooms today. And I believe this is important at any time, but it's especially important now because we're trying to solve these great crises that face us through the thinking of these kinds of false assumptions, in many instances, that led to the problems themselves. So where did these come from? I think maybe the one to start with, the Darwinian assumptions, I think have probably caused some of the greatest suffering in the past that humankind has ever known, and it is actually leading to the collapse of the way we think of business, the way we think of economics and monetary systems. So maybe that's a good place to start, George.
But when it started that way, I'm sure they didn't say, you know, let's trick humanity. Let's give them this assumption of evolution. I think they believed it, didn't they?
Well, absolutely not, George. Now, up until 1859, when the modern world was considered the modern or the Western world, and we asked the questions, who are we? It was the church and the religious community that was answering those questions until 1859. And 1859, Charles Darwin published his first work on the origin of species. And it was important because it was the first time the scientific community had tried to answer the questions that had been answered by the church in the past. And because it was based in science, the ideas put forth, the ideas that Darwin proposed, were accepted, embraced, and became entrenched very quickly in the Western way of thinking. And if you think about it, George, civilization as we know it, is what it is because of the last 150 years and the way we have come to think of ourselves and our relationship to the world and the Darwinian ideas. Now, again, this is just part of the false assumptions. But Darwin made the assumption that nature is based on survival of the fittest, that is often interpreted as survival of the strongest. Now, I think Darwin was, he was a scientist. I think he was probably a good scientist. He could not have possibly known in his time everything that we have come to understand in ours about cells and about DNA.
Well, technology helped us. He didn't have that at his disposal.
Absolutely. And in my opinion, this is where I'm going to deviate from the facts in the book. This is my opinion. I think where Darwin went wrong was he took some observations that he made for some forms of life in one part of the world. He was looking in the Galapagos Islands at insects and animals. He took those assumptions the observations that he made in those places specifically to those forms of life, and he generalized them and tried to apply them to all life, including human life. And this is where the new discoveries simply do not support that assumption. So I think one of the greatest and the most danger that we have seen from this way of thinking is the assumption that comes from a Darwinian thinking that nature is based on survival of the fittest, often interpreted as survival of the strongest. Darwin himself questioned this assumption as he was making it. And what he said, essentially, he said that when we look in nature and we see examples in nature of ants making slaves of other ants, for example, or of one species of bird that kicks another bird out of its nest because it's different from its siblings. He said when we see those little examples in nature, what we're seeing are examples of a general rule that applies to all life. And the rule, I'm sure many of our listeners have heard this, the rule is simply multiply, vary, let the strongest live and the weakest die. Let the strongest live and the weakest die. And this is a very dangerous way of thinking. But he put this forth in 1859, and it was embraced by the scientific community. And much of the way we live our lives today, George, is based upon this way of thinking. The corporations that are having the problems now, the global economic system that is crumbling, when we go to war, when we share our resources, how we help one another through these times of crisis, it is based upon this belief, let the strongest live and the weakest die. And if there's any doubt that is true, all we have to do, and how deeply it has affected us, all we have to do is look at the twisted thinking in the greatest atrocities of the 20th century that are linked directly back to Darwin's ideas. Mein Kampf, Hitler's work, he paraphrased Darwin, but he never gave Darwin credit. Chairman Mao actually quoted Darwin. And he said, because this is based in science, because these ideas of ethnic cleansing are based in science, that it justifies the way he was treating his people in the 20th
Amazing.
Century.
No, you're so right. And you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, Greg, and though we may be the fittest there, we may be the strongest there, they keep coming. They keep coming. And you know what? The fittest and the strongest might not win, might not evolve all the time, look at situations like that.
Precisely, George. And the problem is that the new discoveries simply do not support this assumption of Darwinian thinking. The new discoveries, over 400 peer-reviewed studies were conducted in the late 1990s, and they asked a single question. And the question was this. The studies asked, what is the optimum amount of competition in any environment? And when they talk about competition, it's not a friendly game of chess or soccer. This is violent competition. They said in the classroom, in the workplace, in the family, in the community, what is the optimum amount of competition? And all 400 studies, George, came back with the same number. And the number was zero. Always, 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 competition hurts the individual. Competition hurts the community. And the studies are now showing that nature, while competition may occur, it's not the model. Nature is actually based upon a model of cooperation and mutual aid. I want to share with our listeners, there was in a very prestigious journal New Scientist, there was a fascinating series of articles on precisely this topic. And I just want to share a quote, and the quote is simply this. It says, "What we see in the wild is not every animal for itself. Cooperation is an incredibly successful survival strategy. It has been the basis for most of the dramatic steps in the history of life. When cooperation breaks down, the results can be disastrous." So this is the scientific community now beginning to rethink this idea that nature is based upon survival of the strongest.
Well, finally, whoever wrote that is finally getting it.
Well, there's a growing body of mainstream scientists now that are embracing these principles. But here's why this is important. I was just on this tour in Europe, and people said to me, "Okay, Greg, this is 1859. Darwin put the idea forward. Why is it important? You know, what difference could it possibly make in our lives today? The corporations that we've grown up with for 100 years, they are based in survival of the strongest, what's best for the bottom line. The economic system of the world is based in this principle. The way that we think about money and economics is the outpicturing of the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the world. And these are the very things that are collapsing. So as we build a new economic system, if we embrace the old ideas, we know where that's going to lead. But this is just one example of where a false scientific assumption it's over 150 years old, has had just a horrendous impact upon our lives and our world. And a lot of people don't think about it that way, George. They don't think about the relationship between this way of thinking and what's happening in the world today. And when we begin to recognize where these ideas come from and the horrendous suffering of the 20th century based on these ideas, then it makes perfect sense to embrace the new ideas as we dig our way out of the crises that we now find ourselves in today. And again, this is only one example.
Okay, and you know, two of the assumptions, as we've talked about, are somewhat tied together, the evolution explaining itself, life's itself, and then the survival of the fittest. What about 5,000 years that civilization's been around? I agree with you. I think, taking like Michael Cremo's thoughts, we might be millions and millions of years old.
Well, when I wrote this book, what I had to do, I stuck with the facts, peer-reviewed science, as it stands today. Now, I have my own ideas, and I'm happy to speculate, but here's what the facts are telling us. Right now, our young people in the classrooms, when you were in school, I was in school, our listeners' children in school right now, we're taught that civilization is 5,000 years old, that began with Sumeria, Mesopotamia, with more or less primitive societies that have advanced in a linear fashion. It's a one-way trip to the pinnacle of the sophistication that we see today. And this is a way of thinking only in the Western world, George, because the indigenous traditions have always shared with me that we are the most recent in a series of cycles. But now the archaeology is catching up with this. So if it were only one site that didn't agree with these numbers, it could be an anomaly. But what's happening is there are so many anomalies that are emerging, and they are in peer-reviewed scientific journals, discoveries based in accepted methods of science. The dating methods are accepted methods. The anomalies are now telling a new story. So we can go in, we can start this before the break, and then we can continue after, but what we're finding is that 5,000 years that we are taught is the history of the whole world is not really the history of the whole world. It's the history of the most recent cycle.
That's right.
By the way, happens to tie in with the Mayan calendar and many of the topics that you've had from guests in recent months. But the archaeology now is dating advanced civilization at least twice as old. In Turkey, the Göbekli Tepe site is now scientifically dated 13,500 years old. And there are other sites in that same time range. And for listeners that may not be familiar with the geologic timeline, when we start talking about 13,000 years ago, we're talking about the end of the last ice age. And the question is, who was here to build these advanced civilizations under the conditions of climate that Earth saw during the last ice age, or build them before the ice age happened?
That's right.
Who was here during that period of time? Our history doesn't allow for that. But the science now is telling us very, very clearly that these civilizations, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is one that I just mentioned. Another site in Turkey is called Çatalhöyük, between 8,000 and 9,000 years old. A fascinating site, George, is under 120 feet of water off of India, an area called the Gulf of Kambat. And it's not a small site. It's 5 miles long, 2 miles wide. So, and of course, we've all heard the guests on Coast to Coast in the past, and we've had a lot of exploration of the dating of the Giza Plateau in Egypt.
That's right. Atlantis.
Atlantis. I personally had the opportunity to document a new excavation in northern Peru last June that is now the oldest civilization in all of the Americas. It's older than the Inca, than the Aztec, than the Mayans. It actually is contemporary with ancient Egypt. And it may be one of the missing links of civilization that helps us to understand how the knowledge of architecture and astronomy and mathematics and the cycles of time, how did it show up in the Americas as quickly as it did? Well, these sites are suggesting that there was a bridge between ancient Egypt and the cycles before and what we find in the Americas. So I'd like to talk about all these in more detail, but the key is that the civilization that we have been led to believe is the history of the whole world is only the history of the most recent cycle. And that's important because if advanced civilizations have lived through the cyclic changes in their time that we're living in ours, what can we learn from them? And what mistakes did they make maybe that we can avoid? And what did they do right that we can incorporate into our solutions?
Was it religion, Greg, that pushed this 5,000-year time period?
I think in some parts of the world it is religion.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because there are many religious traditions that say that Earth itself is only 6,000 years old. And if Earth is only 6,000 years old, then it looks really bad if you've got an archaeological site in your backyard 13,500 years old. So I think that is a problem in some parts of the world. But, you know, much of this, and I just want to say this before we go to break, because this is so important. We are taught in our classrooms, our young people are taught today in their textbooks that actually state, George, that war is a natural condition of the human experience, that war is as natural as night and day. It's like commerce. It's something that all humans do. That's a direct quote.
That's frightening. Greg, let's talk more. We've got 2 more hours with you on Coast to Coast AM. Greg Braden, Deep Truth. We'll be back.